I have an undergraduate degree. I graduated in 1984 with a degree in special education, teaching children with emotional problems, which is probably, that's actually the first place I had some introduction to play therapy. At the time in Fairfax County, right outside of Washington, D.C., we had self-contained classrooms and with our self-contained centers within, and I was in an elementary school, so we had a center within a regular education elementary school, and we had our own part-time school psychologist and a part-time social worker, and both of them did play therapy. But after I left, I didn't really have any other contact with play therapy again. So I've worked with kids with emotional difficulties, learning disabilities, middle school, elementary school, adolescents. I've been in residential programs, substance abuse programs. I did get my master's degree in social work in 1992, and with a specialization in child and family welfare. But through all of that, I've been in private practice. I've been worked at a community services board. Through all of that, aside from back in the mid-'80s, it was very difficult to find any play therapy training or any contact. So I just kind of winged it for a while until I actually found someone who introduced me to the Association for Play Therapy. And then that's kind of what got me on my path where I am now. I'm just going to start out a little bit about explaining the power and the benefit of play, and then what play therapy is. In January 2007, the American Academy of Pediatrics wrote a paper about the benefit of play. And this is a quote from that journal. Play allows children to create and explore a world where they can master conquering their fears while practicing adult roles, sometimes in conjunction with other children or adult caregivers. As they master their world, play helps children develop new competencies that lead to enhanced confidence and resiliency that they need to face future challenges. Charles Schaefer, who's one of the bigwigs in the play therapy world, wrote a book called The Therapeutic Power of Play, and he had identified several therapeutic aspects of play therapy. The first one is that play helps to overcome resistance. It's natural, it's fun, it's what they do. So in order to establish that therapeutic alliance, play is the most effective way to do that with children. The other therapeutic benefit of play therapy is communication. Children often have difficulty expressing themselves verbally in order to communicate their feelings, their thoughts, and their needs. Grown-ups have a hard time doing that. Cognitively, children that are a much different place than adults are, so play offers them a natural means of being able to communicate. I don't know if any of you have had small children. I know when my oldest son was little, or if you've ever been around a preschooler, whatever it is they're working out, you'll see them talking it through in their play, and you can kind of get an idea of what's going on. I know for my son, if it wasn't for his little friend Tigger, I wouldn't find out lots of things. The other thing is play, another aspect is it helps to build competence. Children enjoy playing, which means they'll spend a lot of time doing it, and playing allows the opportunity to enhance that self-esteem by satisfying their internal motivation to explore and master the environment. Creative thinking is another aspect. Play encourages creativity and flexibility without fear of negative consequences. They can try out different problem-solving options while. And for some kids, they will punch and punch and punch and punch and punch the bop bag. And as they're punching it, you can actually see them releasing some of that frustration in a way that's much more beneficial than yelling at somebody or kicking somebody or making some other decision that's not so helpful. Another aspect is abreaction. Carl Schaefer states that abreaction is the reliving of past stressful events and the emotions associated with them. In play, children can slowly mentally digest and assimilate traumatic experiences by reliving them with an appropriate release of affect. And the play therapist can help the child to re-experience the event in a different way and gain a sense of mastery in the environment. And I've done that with kids who have experienced sexual abuse or other traumas. And one of the ways that we play that out, I have a lot of sand figures, and I'll have them pick a sand figure for themselves and one for the perpetrator, and they can put it in the sandbox, and then I kind of coach them about, you know, if you could say whatever you wanted to so-and-so, what would you like to say? So they get to express those feelings of powerlessness, feeling hurt, feeling upset, and have an opportunity to work those out without having to actually face the perpetrator. Another therapeutic aspect of play is role-playing. Play allows children to try out different roles and behaviors to experience things from a different perspective and develop a sense of self as separate from others. And a lot of what I see in this is kids, you know, good guys and bad guys, and usually the kids will play out good guys first, and then they try out the bad guy role. I've had another child who, in his play, he was the cooking show host, and we were on TV, and he got to boss around people with his cooking show. So if they didn't treat him well, he would just not show them how to cook. So it gave him a sense of mastery when he was feeling some powerlessness in some areas of his life. Another aspect, therapeutic aspect of play, is fantasy and visualization. Imagination is enhanced through play. Charles Schaefer states, pretending gives a child power over the world, even when he does not have much control in life. This power and control is ego-boosting and augments an inner locus of control. The possibilities with imagination are endless with a child and what he can achieve and overcome. Metaphoric teaching is another therapeutic aspect of play. Play allows the opportunity to develop new myths or metaphors to address issues related to the unconscious content. The therapist can observe a child's fantasy play and gain understanding into the concerns of the child. And I see a lot of that when they do some of the sand tray as well. Attachment formation is another therapeutic aspect. Playful interactions with smiling and positive touch are natural and enjoyable ways for children to connect with adults. Relationship enhancement. Play is a pleasurable bond that's formed that makes each party more attractive to each other, which is, you know, you'll see that in parents playing with their kids and the power of that attachment by getting down there and doing something fun and pleasurable. Well, and it's the same thing in order to be able to build that therapeutic alliance with the kids as well, to give them a space where they feel free to be able to work through whatever it is they need to because they feel comfortable in that relationship. And there are a couple of play therapy theories for family therapy, and the idea is that you teach the parents how to engage in that relationship through playing with their kids to enhance that relationship. Positive emotion is another aspect of the power of play. Playing is fun, and children enjoy it, which can be uplifting for the child and relieve stress. Mastering developmental fears. Children can overcome their fears by repeatedly playing out threatening stimuli and finding ways to master and overcome their fears. One of the ways we, another way of using this therapeutically with the kids, one example would be nightmares. I've had kids who are afraid to go to sleep because they have really, really bad nightmares, so they won't sleep in their own bed. So we'll do silly things, like I'll have them draw a picture of the monster, and then we shred the monster in the paper shredder. Or I'll have them use the figures in the sand tray to best represent the nightmare. And then in the sand tray, I'll figure out where some of the resiliency is, or I'll have them to take themselves and replay the nightmare with them in control. I don't know if any of you have ever read the book by Mercer Mayer, There's a Nightmare in My Closet. So I'll read that to them. But basically, the nightmare is scary, and the boy's waiting for him. He's got his little pop gun, and suddenly the nightmare comes out of the closet. He looks like a big old monster. And so the little boy starts yelling at it, the monster. He's got his pop gun, and he's got his army helmet on, and the monster starts crying. So then, in the end, the little boy has to comfort the monster, and he puts the monster in bed with him. So that's kind of the idea of being able to reconstruct the nightmare that gives the child some power in there, and they can minimize the fears. We do some other things, more cognitive behavioral things, to deal with some irrational fears, different games that we'll play. And then the last thing is gameplay. Playing games involves adhering to a predetermined set of rules, which provides opportunities for children to learn socialization skills. Rules involve playing fair, taking turns, and learning to lose and win graciously. Ego control and focus must override impulsive behaviors. We'll do a lot of this with some of our ADHD kids in the groups. That really helps them to learn the give and take, not being so impulsive, which gets them in trouble with their peers. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar, other than Linda, with the Association for Play Therapy. The Association for Play Therapy is a national organization that focuses on promoting the therapeutic benefits of play therapy, providing support to play therapists in the way of training. They also have a listserv for consulting via email. But they also have a credentialing process for registered play therapists, and I actually am a registered play therapy supervisor, so they provide some oversight with the certain criteria that are involved for that certification. And then every state has their own state chapter, so I'm in Virginia, so we have the Virginia Association for Play Therapy. But the Association for Play Therapy defines play therapy as the systematic use of a theoretical model to establish an interpersonal process wherein trained play therapists use the therapeutic powers of play to help clients prevent or resolve psychosocial difficulties and achieve optimal growth and development. And I think for me, the way I think about play therapy is there's a what makes play therapy different than doing therapy and incorporating play is that it's theory-based. There are probably as many theories for play therapy as there are for adults. So it seems like for every adult therapy there's a play therapy version. Jungian therapy, there's a Jungian play therapy, there's cognitive behavioral play therapy. Carl Rogers developed the client-centered therapy. Well, there's a child-centered therapy that uses those principles, and probably Virginia Axlein is one of the most well-known gurus for that. She wrote the book, Dibs in Search of Self. So there's a psychosocial play therapy. They're all grounded in theory, and then the theory has a model that you use to implement the play therapy. And I use more of an integrated approach. I'll use I default to the child-centered play therapy, and the basic underlying principles of child-centered play therapy is that the therapist is the toy. The key for child-centered play therapy is the relationship between the child and the therapist. And the way I think about that is, and that's the healing power, and the child-centered, as with client-centered, believes that internally there's an intrinsic desire for wholeness. So if you provide the free and open space for the child to be able to work through that process and you're there walking alongside, they will naturally move towards healing and wholeness. For me, child-centered play therapy, the way I think about the healing aspect of it is, think about my relationship with God. With God, I am completely acceptable. Even when I mess up, He still loves me unconditionally. The relationship is never separated unless I do the separating. He won't. And so when I think about the healing part of it, think about when you have that time with God and you're just in His presence and He just thinks you're so awesome and He just loves you so much and you just feel so good and just is awesome. That is the basic idea of child-centered. It's about the relationship. So we do set boundaries, but God sets boundaries for us also, and the reason we have the boundaries is to protect the relationship. So we do set boundaries, and it like, for instance, the rule is you can't shoot the therapist with the dart gun. And why would I set that boundary? Because if the child kept shooting me every time he came, at some point in time, I'm not going to want to play with him, because I'm getting a bit tired of being shot at. So I need to set a therapeutic boundary. The rule is you can't shoot the therapist. So, you know, that's the whole point of the rules. So my default is child-centered. And then from there, the younger kids typically, in my opinion, do best with child-centered. They're the ones in charge. They're the ones leading the play. We track them verbally. We track their behavior. We track their emotions. We track along with them so that they know we're connected with them through the process. And then in our verbal tracking, we'll kind of mirror what we're seeing in the play to bring it to the surface. And the theory would say then that they're, you know, when they're ready, they'll integrate that in to the healing process. Now, the other, when I'm integrating other theories in, I typically add in more of a directed play therapy. Directed play therapy can be prescriptive play therapy theory, which is Charles Schaefer's theory that he's developed, which is basically you prescribe a strategy to address the needs of the child. So with prescriptive play therapy, because you're using a variety of strategies, you have to understand the theory behind each of the strategies that you're using. For instance, if you're using a cognitive behavioral strategy, you need to understand the theory of cognitive behavioral when you're using that so that you can use it effectively. So I'll integrate in some more directed, the older kids, right around, in my experience, probably when they get around 9-ish, they start moving a little bit more towards having me integrate more directed. Some of the directed things that I'll use are some cognitive behavioral games, for instance, they'll will draw a big old target on the whiteboard. And if I'm using a cognitive behavioral for anxiety, then we'll write in each of the levels for the target one of their fears, and they have to shoot it and tell it the truth, which is basically changing the negative self-talk. So those are some of the more directed things that I do to integrate those in there. From a spiritual standpoint, I'm going to end with this. The way I think about the importance of utilizing play therapy when we're working with children, Jesus said, "Let the little children come unto me," which is basically don't hinder them from experiencing their healing and his presence. But if we don't utilize, in my opinion, an effective strategy to work with kids at their developmental and cognitive level, then we are a hindrance because we really aren't meeting them where they are. And Jesus always approached people at their level. And in my opinion, play therapy is a way that you meet kids where they are, which is also one of the basic principles of social work, is to meet the client where they are. Well, play is the natural language of children. Play is to children as words are to adults. So if I'm going to meet a child where that child is, I'm going to interact with that child through playing. I'm going to use playing as an aspect of the therapeutic relationship to enhance it, to be able to engage with that child and to develop that therapeutic relationship where we... And the relationship is half of the therapeutic process, not necessarily just the skill and the knowledge. But if you don't have the relationship, it's very difficult to help them through that process of overcoming the things that they need to overcome. So I think I was close. That's pretty much my presentation.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kathy. A couple things. I wanted to add related to the spiritual aspect, too, that I thought was in preparation for the call today was, and I agree, the first thing I wrote on my list, Kathy, was accepting people where they are, because I think Jesus did that. And I agree that I use the same scripture reference that you did. Mm-hmm. But I also think that he also had a tremendous amount of compassion for those that were under stress, and that makes it that much more important for the children that are under as much stress. If they need some kind of therapy, then there's, you know, then they've got to have some compassion, even if they are the kind of kid that reacts in very angry and oppositional ways when they're under stress. We've got to really kind of see them in a different light and approach them in a different way. So I also think that Jesus met people individually, too. I mean, he got with them where they were as far as what their needs were and met them without having to, you know, says, well, I have to do it this way or I have to do it that way because that's what I'm told to do. He basically was creative and showed his compassion and met them in their place and he, of course, was the ultimate in success about it. So thank you for those thoughts and in that direction. Just to open up, is there anybody that has any questions or comments about Kathy's presentation?
Yes, this is Kathy from East Liverpool, Ohio, and I opened a Pathway Counseling Center last April and was just wondering if you could shed some light, as I actually have a specialization in families and children, but not a lot of experience in actually facilitating it in the actual room with the clients. And one of the issues going on lately is the children of divorce. I have a 9-year-old, and wondered if you had any light to shed on. I know we've been working with feelings and making faces with paper plates and such to help her identify and have a feelings journal. Drawing her pictures, like an art journal. But I wondered if there are any other things you might shed on that. With what's happening is the parents are getting ready. The one has already remarried, and the other is about to merge two siblings with another two siblings, and then a new dad. So, a little hit.
Yeah. You know, first and foremost, whenever I think about that process, I think for the kids, the grief process and their sense of powerlessness, because they always want the parents. Well, let me rephrase that. They want the parents to be back together, and that's always there for them. So having to accept in new people is very hard for them, because on some level it's confirmation that my parents are not going to get back together, which is very, very, very hard for them. When I work with kids who are whose parents are divorced, and Linda's actually got something she can share that I was going to tell you about too. She uses mandalas, because they're awesome. I have a few things that I'll do with the kids. One is, if they're able, some kids are not able to emotionally acknowledge. So for those kids, I'll typically allow them to choose, and I'll use more of a child-centered play therapy approach. In that process, they lead, I follow, and then I look at what's going on. I'll look at the themes in the play. I'll look at what's going on in their relationship with me to try and understand what it is that they're working through. If they're able to articulate, or if they're able to let me lead a little bit, I may use some directive approaches. One of them would be a before and after picture. So I take a big piece of paper, I fold it in half. On one side at the top of the page, I'll write before, and on the other side, I'll write after. And then I'll say, well, draw a picture of what life was like before your parents separated and what life was like now that they have separated. Or draw a picture of what it was like before your mom got married or your dad got married to so-and-so, and draw a picture of what it's like now. I also do another activity, which is actually pretty telling. I take a big piece of paper, and I ask them if they would draw a family shield. So that it takes up the whole page, and there are four aspects to the shield. And the way I explain the shield is, you know, just like in the medieval days, when they would go out and fight, the knights would have shields, and the shields would have pictures on them, and the pictures would represent that family and what that family was about. So I'm going to have you make a family shield, and in the family shield, you have to draw a picture that represent one that'll show who's in your family. And they'll always ask, well, who do I have to draw? I'll say, whoever you want to draw, you can draw. So who's in your family? What do you like best about your family? Another picture to show, what do you like to do best with your family? And then this one I leave for the last, because it's always the most telling, which is, what do you like least about your family? And I don't really comment. I'll just, you know, go with what they say. If they don't put something in there about the divorce, that in and of itself is telling. And I've had kids where I've done that one at the very beginning of treatment, where they wouldn't acknowledge anything about the divorce. They weren't talking about it. They weren't acknowledging it. And then later on in the treatment process, where they would make a shield, and they would put in there, what do I like least? I like least that my parents got a divorce. And they'll draw a picture of that. And Linda, do you want to say something about the mandalas?
Yes, actually I can really quick. The little boy that I seem to be using them with the most right now is, he came to me for assistance in transitioning into a blended family. finding out that he actually is coming into therapy for the second time, the first time for a very traumatic loss of his mother. And I'm finding that he's really not at the point of blending with a family right now because he's still doing some grief work. I've used the mandalas with him just as, I guess to make a long story short, they're a holding place. They're a bowl that just holds all of these anger emotions that have been rising in the past few weeks. And he is very, very, I don't know the word that I'm trying to use, but you put that circle in front of him and he just jumps right into it. There is never a hesitation. There's no more of an explanation of, you don't need to give him an explanation of what this is for. He knows that this is his safe holding place, and he pours out. He pours out and he fills that circle with all the stuff that's inside him. And just a couple weeks ago, he was so overflowing with anger that he also took it and ripped it up, which was very telling, and we have since processed that. But I have found that the mandala with the children that I am working with have just been a really positive avenue, way for them to let out some of those feelings that they don't have words for. And even to the point that I think it surprises them just a little bit.
Now, I'm not sure what you're saying,
mandala. Can someone explain to me what the mandala is?
That's what I was wondering.
Yes. A mandala goes back to, oh my goodness, ancient times. They're a very ritualistic, religious form of religious practice in the Buddhist faith and the Hindu faith, used by Tibetan monks. Jung did a lot of work with mandalas from a psychoanalytical standpoint. Personally, I'm not going there. I take the mandala all the way back to the creation of the world, and that although our scientists will call this Earth a sphere, and yes, I guess in scientific terms it is, but when our human eyes look at our Earth, we see a circle. So I see the origination of a mandala as being created by God. And basically, depending on what theoretical orientation you're coming from, is going to determine how you present this and what you take from it. I am not trying to psychoanalyze where my children are at. From my client-centered approach, this circle represents their holding place. When I originally explained it, I used a metaphor of a bowl under running water and how the water fills the bowl up. And if you don't turn the water off, it overflows the sides. And the circle is the bowl, and what they feel is the water. And that's the metaphor I use to explain it to them. And they take it from there, believe me. And I accept what they give. I do not read in to what they are giving me.
Mm-hmm.
Does that
help at all? Right. And the way I think of it also, it's kind of another projective technique. Like sand trays are projective, art is projected. The mandala is another type of art activity. It does have spiritual roots to it. So there's a spirituality to it. And my belief is truth is truth. You can call it whatever you want to call it, but I know who the originator of truth is. And if you steal some of my truth and give it a different name, God is still truth. But I look at it as a projective, because even though they don't have the words to say what they need to say, by expressing it through the art or expressing it through the sand tray with the symbols, they still get to work it out, and they don't necessarily have to have words to do it.
Thank you, Kathy. That's very, very true.
Yeah,
thank you.
This is Ken Smith from North Carolina. And could you give me the name again of the author that wrote that book about the nightmares?
Oh, Mercer Mayer.
How do you spell that?
He did the Little Critters series also. Okay. Mercer is
M-E-R-C-E-R.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. Mayer's M.
What is it? Where
is it? I think it's M-A-Y-E-R.
But I'm not positive.
Oh, here it is. M-A-Y-E-R, yeah.
M-A-Y-E-R. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. There's also another book, if you want one for anxiety, that's awesome.
Okay.
It was written by H. Norman Wright.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He's a Christian guy.
Sure, we're very familiar with him.
Yeah. And he wrote with Gary Oliver, he wrote a book called Fears, Doubts, Blues, and Pouts.
Okay.
They're stories about handling fear, anxiety, worry, sadness, and anger.
Okay.
And in there's four stories. There's one story in there about Bruce Moose and the What If. And I use that one a lot. The What Ifs are our irrational fears.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And so I'll read the story to them. We talk about what a what if is, and then we blow up balloons together, and I take a marker. I usually take a Sharpie because the kids' markers rub off all over the place. It's a giant mess.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll say to them, okay, so, and I may use this with feelings too, so this might also, it probably would be helpful also for kids of divorce. But if I'm using it after I've read the story, Bruce Moose and the What If, I'll say, okay, tell me something you worry about. And they'll say, I worry when I go to sleep at night, a bad guy will come in the house and kill me. Or another worry might be, I worry if I don't see my mom, then she's going to die. That's the separation anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So then we write that on there. And then now we know from the story the only way to get rid of the what if are to tell them the truth. So then I say, okay, you have to, what's the truth? Is a bad guy going to come in your house? Has anybody in your neighborhood ever had any bad guys come in their house and kill them off? So what's the likelihood a bad guy is going to come into your house? And if they're Christian, if the kids are Christian, I'll say, well, what would God say? Who protects you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, God protects me. So what did he say? God says he watches over me in my sleep. And then I'll show them the scripture verse with that.
Okay.
So then what they do is I give them a popping utensil, which is a thumbtack.
Mm-hmm.
And I close my ears and scream and laugh. And they have to say it out loud and tell it the truth. When they tell it the truth, they get to pop it. And that's where we scream and laugh. You can also vary that for feelings. Write a feeling and what happens when you have that feeling. Or I get mad when my brother takes my toy. I get sad when my mom yells at me. And then they get to pop it. So that's another way just to be able to identify feelings and the triggers for the feelings. And then, well, we may also develop a coping skill. If that happens, what's another way of thinking about it? Well, does my mom still love me if she yells at me? What is that? Is she really yelling at me? So those kinds of things, too.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you.
What is the name of the lady that is real big in the play therapy world? She's written books on it and has done seminars on it. I just can't remember her name. I've not been in this for a while.
Oh, there's actually a bunch. Heidi Kadison?
Elena Gill is one, I think.
Oh, Eliana Gill. She's awesome.
That's it.
Oh, Eliana Gill, yeah.
Eliana Gill, yeah.
She's done a lot of
first name, but,
yeah. Yeah, she actually has a website, elianagill.com, and it's Eliana with one N. She does some trainings around this area. She's actually from here. So she's
and
actually
where are you calling from?
Virginia, right outside Washington, D.C.
Okay. Cool, thank you for that.
She's done a lot of work with trauma.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Heidi Kadison and Charles Schaefer are together, and they've edited a lot of books together. They do the prescriptive which is basically more directed play therapy. So you can find 101 play therapy techniques, more 101 play therapy techniques. Those are good books, too.
Okay.
Paris Goodyear Brown is another one that does a lot of prescriptive, and she's got some books out with a lot of different activities. Although, she must be rich, because she uses a lot of stuff. I got to keep mine low budget.
Are there books that you can recommend about using play therapy with teens or groups of teens?
Yeah, there are some books, actually. And I when I work with teenagers, and actually I make the grown-ups play, too. If you go to the, there's two websites that'll have some really good books. I don't know offhand the books, but if you go to the Association for Play Therapy website, they have a bookstore, and the website is the letter A, the number 4, the letter P like play, and T like therapy. A4PT.org. The other one is Self-Esteem Shop. And I can't remember if it's selfesteemshop.com or .org. I think it's probably .com.
Okay.
And if you call them, she knows. It's a family-run business, and they have a ton of books. And they know all of the books that they have.
Okay.
I don't know how you remember all these things, but they do. And they're very helpful. If you have it, an issue or something in particular, they'll tell you which books they would recommend.
Okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Jenny Leiter from Akron, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for your time and for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome.
Question for you. If you had a 3-year-old came in to you that was abused by his father and his girlfriend, and is that a sexual abuse or
physical?
Physical. Malnutrition?
Physical.
Physical.
Mm.
So if you had a 3-year-old that came in abused by father and girlfriend, malnutrition, physical abuse, what would be some of the therapies that you would use in this situation?
With a 3-year-old, I use strictly child-centered play therapy, which is basically the child leads. And I track with the child. And then I look at, with child-centered play therapy, there are 4 stages. There's the exploratory phase, the aggressive phase, which the exploratory phase is the equivalent in grown-up therapy to coming in and checking out your therapist. And, you know, you haven't fully opened up yet. You're trying to see if you feel comfortable. You're building that comfort level. The aggressive phase equivalent in grown-up talk therapy is coming in and talking about, you know, you're so mad at your husband, he's such a butthead, your boss is an idiot, you're sick of your kids yelling and screaming, life sucks. Then the next phase in child-centered is the regressive phase, which I always call the nurturing phase. And that's basically that phase, you go much deeper into the unconscious content, what's really, really, really hurting down there. So in that phase, you'll see a lot of nurturing play. Maybe a doctor is coming in to help, or somebody is hungry and you're cooking some food for the doctor. Basically, you see some kind of helping going on or nurturing in that phase. And the equivalent in grown-up therapy would be when you get to that deeper level of the therapeutic relationship where you can look at what is underneath why you're upset with your husband. You feel abandoned. You never got those needs met growing up, and now here again. So what are some ways you can get that need met? Or, you know, parenting didn't turn out the way you thought it would, and you're really sad and disappointed about that. So you go to a much deeper level to get at those places that really need to be healed underneath the surface content. And then the final phase would be mastery phase, and this is where you come around to the other side of whatever it is that the issue is, and you've figured out a way to resolve it, to master it, to look at it a different way. It's no longer holding you the way it used to, which is similar in adult therapy, regular talk therapy, where they've come to accept whatever it is and found ways to get those needs met in a different way, being able to let go and forgive and move on. So with a three-year-old, I strictly use child-centered, and they'll play out the themes. Eliana Gill did a lot of work with kids who experienced trauma. She's got a book called Play Therapy with Traumatized Children. And what you want to look for in there are ways to help them come to terms with the abuse and getting some of their emotional needs met. The therapeutic relationship should, for a three-year-old, the healing and the connecting part, especially at that age, should do some healing in and of itself. But they'll lead the way. So basically they tell you with their playing when they're ready to address what, and you'll look for which phase that they're in the treatment process.
Could you spell Eliana Gale, please?
It's Eliana, L, E like elephant, L like Larry, I, A, N like Nancy, A, that's Eliana, her last name is Gill, G like girl, I, L. And her website is ElianaGill.com.
Thank you so much. Does anybody?
Oh, you're welcome. She's got a lot of good, stuff on working with traumatized kids.
Have three people listening.
And so does Liana Lowenstein. And I think Liana is. I think she's from Canada. Liana is spelled L-I-A-N-A or two N's, and then Lowenstein, L-O-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. And if you go on the APT bookstore or self-esteem shop, they'll have both of those authors.
Hello, this is Sean from Maine. And,
hi.
I had a question about, you'd spoken something about catharsis. And,
I'm sorry, about what?
You've spoken some about catharsis.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so, and my question about that was, if you could talk about when you tend to use it, and when are there times that you think it's, you know, contraindicated to use it or not.
Right.
So, because there are times that I've brought it up with parents, and whether that's in the therapy session or that they're looking for something to do at home. And questions about whether they're going to be, learning a behavior to do something that is, you know, going to be hurtful or maladaptive or something. And so I'm just wondering when you have seen it to be helpful and when you might not have seen it to be helpful.
Right. The way I think about that is because I defaulted child-centered. I think a child is going to know when they're ready to get there. The other thing is, usually after you've built a really strong therapeutic relationship and you've worked through some of the other things, like for instance, I had a 9-year-old girl that had been working with a Christian family. Awesome, awesome, awesome. She had been sexually molested over a period of a year and a half to 2 years or something. And when she came to see me, she was 9, and it had just been disclosed. And so we did a variety of things. She did a lot of sand trays. I did some guided imagery art activities, and she wrote a story to go with it. And the story was awesome. And at some point in time, you know, things were, she was having a lot of difficulty getting to the anger. Because, you know, Christians aren't supposed to be angry. We're supposed to forgive everybody and smile a lot. But truly, we are angry sometimes. And if someone has sexually abused me, I'm going to be angry about it. And in order to work through the treatment process effectively, we really do have to come to terms and address those ugly feelings of anger. So what she would do, I had a few things that I would do with her, work things out in the Santray where she got to tell her perpetrator how she felt about what he did. And then on her own, she started hitting the Bob bag. And so I kind of went with that. And by this time, she and I had a very good relationship. And so I would say, oh, it makes you so mad when, you know, blah, 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 touched you, that, you know, made you feel uncomfortable. Ooh, she gave him a big old whack. And she was laughing. And so I said, oh, that makes you so mad. You're just going to give him a big old punch. And so then she kind of took it over there. She would say, well, blah, 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 I'm going to hit you in the head. And she would pound and laugh. And for her, it was very cathartic that she could own some, you know, there's a sense of powerlessness when you're talking about trauma. And the powerlessness can be devastating, especially for kids, in a lot of ways, because they're powerless in general. I mean, the grown-ups call all the shots. And so to have a grown-up do that, for her, she had to come to terms and accept that being angry wasn't all that bad.